Undeceptions podcast.
Welcome to With All Due Respect, where we discuss the big topics with respect and grace. I'm Megan Powell-Dutoit and he's...
I'm Michael Jensen.
Well, Jesus famously said, you cannot serve both God and money, or wealth, depending on the translation. While Christian scandals often involve abuse of sex or power, love of money seems to be the sin we often tolerate. Is that because Christians in the West have been living under capitalism for quite some time now? Capitalism gets quite a bad rap these days, so we want to ask, is it the root of all evil? And how should Christians relate to issues of money and ownership? We then talk to an economist about how economics and faith might interrelate. And we finish with a show which has been called a satire of late capitalism, Apple TV's Severance.
For argument's sake, where we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. And today we're asking, is capitalism the root of all evil? And that's a rephrase of another statement by Jesus, of course, that the love of money or wealth or mammon maybe is a root of all kinds of evil. The Cambridge Dictionary defines capitalism as an economic and political system in which property, business and industry are controlled by private owners rather than the state with the purpose of making a profit. No, neither Megan or I are economists. I did 3 in an economics at the HSC. Does that count?
Did you? It's more than me, okay?
But that was in 1988. Things have changed since then, but several crashes later.
Yeah.
So we aren't going to get into the nitty-gritty of it as a system. Rather, as theologians, we want to ask questions about the concepts underlying it, concepts such as ownership and the profit motive, to think about how we as Christians might live in this area, in this era, I should say, often called late-stage capitalism. So what do you think? Late-stage capitalism, is greed good in some sense at least? Megan, what do you think?
I mean, I think there's sort of an honesty about capitalism in a way, which is that people are going to work for the good of themselves, and so that's something that can be harnessed. So in that way, you know, you can argue all you want about what system you're going to have, but the system has to take account of the reality of human beings. Is it the root or is it a root of a contemporary problem? I think it is one of the problems of contemporary society, but it's not the only one. It's not sort of sometimes it gets talked about as the catch-all problem that faces us.
Yeah, I mean, famously, of course, Marx in the 19th century is, you know, this is his diagnosis is that capitalism is the human problem that needs to be solved. We need to move on. Mm. You know, history needs to progress beyond capitalism for us to come up with a more just and equitable society. And this, I think there's something that kind of meshes with Christianity in some of his diagnoses. I mean, he's dealing, of course, in the mid-19th century with in the first waves of industrialization, where you have the worst effects of that kind of unfettered capitalism, the factories, children in the factories, the dark satanic mills and all the rest. So you can see that capitalism certainly needed some brakes put on it. But was it corrupted as a system? Essentially.
I mean, I do think whatever system that we want to work with as Christians, and to some extent we don't have a lot of control over it, but it has to be something that acknowledges the fallenness of human beings and works with that realistically, but with hope, I think, that there can be, you can counteract some of that fallenness, that there is also a move within the human being to common good. So, I mean, personally, and I am seriously no expert here, I do think that Christians perhaps don't sign off to any particular system, but are looking for ways in the system to counteract some of that selfishness and sin that abounds.
Yeah, so that, I mean, one of the problems we have here is that particularly Protestant Christians have been almost blamed for the invention of capitalism in the 16th, 17th and 18th century in Holland and in England in particular. Max Weber, the great German sociologist, kind of blamed, he talked about Protestantism as sort of essential to capitalism. And why was that? I think he was trying to say, look, Protestantism's idea of freedom, the freedom of the individual, when translated into economic sense, actually kind of then kind of leads to this idea that you're free to buy and sell. And he also saw the whereas prior to the Reformation there'd been a great sort of wave of forbidding of usury of charging interest. Mm. That changed, and Protestants were quite happy to charge interest and to borrow money at interest, and that actually has led to the capital to what we have, what we know as capitalism.
Yeah, and I do think within the Protestant tradition. And this, I mean, Anabaptists, for instance, would have quite a lot of questions about this. So it's, you know, you can make it too monolithic. But I do think there hasn't been enough investigation of some of the really basics behind it. Like, should Christians consider that they own things privately? Is that a Christian view of how possessions work or money works?
Well, I guess the Ten Commandments are interesting here. We've just been working through them in church, and the idea that there's stealing kind of means that there's sort of an assumption that there is private property. But on the other hand, the Torah very much talks about the things we own as gifts from God. There's grace involved even in the creation and the ownership of things. And that's where I think moving away from a kind of a theistic or Judeo-Christian worldview to a system where what I have is what I've managed to grab and I deserve it is very much a very different kind of way of thinking about property, which then kind of leads you to have this kind of ontological connection to the things you own.
I mean, when you're thinking about the Old Testament, I think what's interesting is there's a recognition that I think owning things is just, it's a really ineffective way to live if you couldn't have some kind of private ownership, right? But I think if you think about some of the law in the Old Testament, for instance, you know, if you've got two cloaks and your neighbour is without one, you are meant to give one to your neighbour. That's put into the law. So there is a sense of in the Old Testament, and then you've also got the concept of Jubilee, that there's got to be a reset every few years. So I think there is a concept of not allowing sort of unfettered accumulation.
Yeah, that's really interesting because one of the issues I think the world faces is the accumulation of capital, where people just accumulate and accumulate and accumulate and generationally pass on wealth. Mm. It's actually a source of great inequity in terms of wealth distribution. And interestingly, the Bible says it has this reset point where there is a kind of redistribution in that way. You can't do that. Although at the same time, I mean, there are principles there. I don't think we would kind of, I mean, we're talking about an agricultural economy too.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there is a point at which we've got people in our culture at the moment who have so much money they could never, ever possibly spend it all. It's you know, it's several degrees of magnitude beyond any kind of necessity for the rest of their lives or their children's lives. Like when you're getting into billionaires, I don't think we kind of grasp how much money that actually is. It's a ridiculous amount of money. And, you know, arguably society, you know, no individual really sort of deserves that amount. That's society is a community. There needs to be a sense of no one's an island. And if you've accumulated that much money, you've done so perhaps in a way which is off the backs of everybody else.
Well, I mean, is that's an assumption that you can make meeting someone who's very rich?
Well, someone at some point has, you know, you get to that amount of money because of the contribution of all other people. None of us are disconnected from each other. And I think that's something where that individualistic idea of how property works is something I don't think is fundamentally Christian, in the sense of we don't own things for our own benefit.
And that's interesting because I think there's a purpose or a teleological question here. We talk about property, business and industry for the purpose of making a profit. Mm. I don't think the profit motive is necessarily a bad thing. It's just that shouldn't be the only reason to own things. And certainly the profit itself is not a means in and of itself. I think that's one crucial thing. It too needs to be a purpose
about
that as well.
Ridiculous thing with what people call late stage capitalism of, you know, just unfettered growth, that you've always got to post a bigger and bigger return. and that's what is the reason? It sort of consumes itself in a way. But on the other hand, to have be able to produce so that you produce jobs, so that you support other people, so that you can be generous, so that we can all flourish. That's a kind of a different way of understanding the profit motive.
Yeah, and I think we've lost our sense too, perhaps, that corporations have an institutional responsibility. Mm. So many of the great institutions, the banks and financial institutions of our society, have Christian and different as Christian beginnings, and very much oriented to social goods, right? Protecting people from evils. But once that's lost and you become merely beholden to shareholders, you lose that sort of institutional responsibility. And I think that's something that our community needs to address at this point.
So, what do you think, as a sort of a Christian who's not necessarily, I mean, some people who are listening to us may have a lot of more control over this than we do, but how does a Christian do you respond to this world in which the profit motive is so significant?
Well, we might ask an expert.
Okay, let's do that. Well, still to come, we have taken a theological lens, but next up, we have a man who's lectured in economics at Oxford, who's written about Christians and economics, and he himself, of course, is a Christian. And then one of the most compelling TV series of the moment, set in a corporate dystopia, Severance.
Now, Megan, our friends at Anglican Aid have got a new program for supporting persecuted Christians, and They've got some really great resources to share with us.
Yeah, so this is a program where they're actually giving to you to help you pray for persecuted Christians around the world. So if you go to anglicanaid.org.au, they've got prayer slides, they've got that you can use with your church, they've got a devotional, they've got a video that you could show which looks at, for instance, Afghan refugees who've been persecuted under the Taliban, and Christians from Nigeria who've been attacked as well. So there's quite a few resources there, which is, you know, this is an area we really should be giving both prayer and other support, and this is resourcing that, so that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I really like that it's not vague, it's quite specific. It takes us to the ground, to where things are actually happening, so we can be well informed as we pray and pray fervently indeed that God would end this kind of persecution. So sign up to receive the prayer points at anglicanaid.org.au. Now, we're joined today by Associate Professor Gordon Menzies at UTS, and Gordon teaches economics there, and he's got under his belt a University Teaching Prize, congratulations, and International Research Prize, and is also a recent COVID author of a book called Western Fundamentalism, which was shortlisted for last year's Christian Book of the Year. So welcome, Gordon. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, you're an academic economist. Why is it that our economic system, what we might call capitalism or what you call free market liberalism, why is it so popular?
Well, I think the key lies in the middle word of free market liberalism, the market. So the market is an incredibly effective social organizing device people have discovered over many decades, many centuries, really. So in a market system, prices do what central planners had to do in the old Soviet Union. The prices, as it were, tell consumers what to do and tell producers what to do. So, for example, if there was a huge storm and a banana crop got wiped out, if you lived in North Korea, I don't know if they grow bananas in North Korea, but if you lived there, the dictators or the government would point guns at people and say to the people consuming bananas, consume less bananas because we've had a storm. They'd point guns at the producers and say, produce more bananas. In our system, if there is a huge storm and the banana crop gets wiped out, the prices will rise. And then exactly the same thing that would happen in North Korea will happen, as it were, automatically. The higher prices will discourage consumers from buying bananas, they'll buy something else, and the higher prices will encourage producers. So these kinds of mechanisms that prices, the mechanism of the price telling consumers and producers what to do has proven to be very effective. And we can see this in comparing different countries that have very similar cultures, very similar histories, and yet they're divided very neatly for a central planning system and a market system. So North and South Korea, East and West Germany when that existed, and the old Hong Kong and China.
So is the key difference that you don't have the guns? Is that really the issue? It's a different kind of gun, Michael. It's the coercion.
So the coercion, it's not just the coercion, it's actually the planning of knowing what to do. It is a really complicated problem to work out how to organize production and consumption in something as myriad and complex as a modern economy. So in the old Soviet Union, they had brilliant mathematicians working on all this kind of stuff all the time. And so it's a very difficult problem, very difficult organizational problem.
And so what should we as Christians, and I speak here as someone without any knowledge in the area, but as Christians, how do we relate to the different economic systems? Is there a reason to prefer one over the other, or is it a matter of more of effectiveness?
Well, there's a number of different issues. So obviously if something's not effective, then if the economy doesn't work very well, then there's a lower material standard for which you might want to do other things like raise the standard of living of poor people and so on. So effectiveness is important. Mm-hmm. I suppose some of it comes down to how you view the government, whether you think that the government is a force for good, and how it might be a force for good versus how you view local communities. So I think I really like the title of this show, with all due respect. And so I think whenever you're talking about people's opinions on things, you should pick the best possible representation of the opinion. And so, for example, I'm not myself a very strong right-wing person politically, but I think the best defense that you could give for it is something called communitarianism, which is the idea that people live out their lives most effectively in a local community, and local community relationships are the things that matter the most. So you see this in the Christian scriptures with the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan deals with the person, as it were, right in front of him, and that's where the story goes. And there's a lovely part of the Screwtape Letters where the junior devil is being encouraged to push the patient's virtue as far away from him as possible into obscure causes in faraway places and to still hate his mother.
Yeah. Remember it.
So the best, I think the best defense of a sort of completely hands-off attitude of the government, and if the government's hands are way off, then there's still the question of how the economy is going to be run, and then the answer is the market. You just let the free market do everything. So that's the best defense that can begin with that. But there are problems with the market.
Yes, of course.
Well, it would be interesting to talk about those problems and what to do about them. So just the freedom in and of itself doesn't. It's a sort of blind force, isn't it? The market. It doesn't have compassion.
Yeah. So there's really the point about compassion is an excellent one, and I'll come to that in a moment. There's really three things that economists worry about the market. The first is that for markets to work well, there have to be lots of buyers and sellers. And when there aren't, people can exploit the fact that there's only a few buyers and sellers to their advantage. So that's why we have things like the ACCC in Australia, competition and competition bodies that try and guarantee competition. The second reason is that markets are not very good at dealing with sort of hidden forces in the production process. They're called, the technical word is externalities, or sort of knock-on effect. And the classic example, of course, is pollution. If something is produced with a very polluting technology, or when it's finished with, it's going to cause a massive problem, like a swirl of plastic in the Pacific Ocean, markets don't necessarily include that in the price. And so people can go around making their market choices, and these big problems are building up, which the market doesn't solve, and governments have a role to play there. The third one, which goes to your point about compassion, is that markets create a kind of social air that we breathe. And when we start to believe that life is a series of trades based on our own advantage and us dealing as individuals, what some people call neoliberalism, when it gets to that stage, markets are a corrosive social force.
Which is making me think of climate change, obviously, is one thing that would be, is that one of the things in the system that's not accounted for by the market?
Yes, exactly. That's an excellent example. So when we buy things, or when we drive our cars in particular, where the choices that we make about driving our cars are having a knock-on effect, which we don't intend when we drive our cars, to the whole world with the buildup of of CO2 emissions. So that's of course, the most pressing example at the moment.
So what about freedom? Like the ideal of freedom lies at the heart of our economic system. It's not just Braveheart. You know, they may take our lives, but it'll never take our freedom. that was my best Edinburgh Braveheart.
That's probably better than my trial, to be fair.
And it's right at the heart of our economy too. So isn't it a good thing, a noble aspiration? After all, it's good to oppose tyranny. We wouldn't want to be going back to a strictly planned economy at the point of a gun, for instance.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, obviously, freedom's opposite is tyranny if you're talking about political freedom. I think freedom is a cherished value in the West. It's absolutely fundamental. It really defines us. So the core values of the West, I would say, are a cherishing of democracy, free market liberalism, free markets, and sexual freedom. Mm-hmm. And democracy frees us from dictators. The market economy frees us from government restrictions to trade. And sexual freedom frees us to have sex with anyone, regardless of any pre-commitments, so long as it's adult and consensual. So the mainstream view goes now. And this kind of freedom, I think, is right at the heart of the West. And it's freedom from all constraints. And then a kind of paradise is supposed to happen because we're all basically good, as we know. I'm not speaking as a Christian when I say that. We're all supposed to be basically good. We just need a little bit of an education program or a new organization, new government program or a syllabus, and we'll gently be guided towards this paradise. Our Christian conception of freedom is different from that. Jesus said the greatest cause of unfreedom was sin. Whoever commits sin is a slave to sin, and if the Son makes you free, you'll be free indeed. And then that's the freedom from bit, but there's also a freedom for bit, which is adoption into God's family, and that carries a whole set of expectations and empowerment for human flourishing. So the West is not into freedom for, it's only into freedom from, and then paradise kind of spontaneously happens.
And you've just written a book about Western fundamentalism, bringing up the West. So why do you use that term of Western fundamentalism?
I use the term fundamentalism as an invitation to respectful dialogue. Mm-hmm. So I think that the original Christian fundamentalists did a number of things. They said what their basic beliefs were, they acknowledged that they weren't 100% provable, and then they connected those basic beliefs to their detailed opinions. Now, if someone asks me now if I'm a fundamentalist, they might mean, are you anti-intellectual, violent, so on?
Yeah.
And my answer would be, no, I'm not. But if someone means, are you someone who knows what your basic beliefs are, realizes that they're not 100% provable using science and so on, and then connects those basic beliefs to my detailed opinions, well, yes, I want to be that kind of person. I think nobody, philosophers tell us over the 20th century, is in the position of being able to claim that their basic beliefs are 100% provable. We're all in the same boat. This should humble us and it should make for much clearer conversations. If I can use a little analogy, you know, some people, when they're going along, their car's not doing so well, will push the accelerator harder. Mm-hmm. Other people will pull over to the side of the road and have a look under the bonnet. I think too much discourse today is about pushing the accelerator harder, shouting louder, yeah. You know, just lobbying and not debating, and we should be looking under the hood a bit more.
So what kind of fundamentalists are Westerners, and how does economics fit into this picture? Because it sounds to me like you're taking those three types of freedom, political, sexual, and economic, and you're saying there's strong parallels and overlaps between them.
Yeah. So I got the idea of Western fundamentalism from when I was at the Oxford Union, the debating society. I became dissatisfied with the debates because they seemed to be somehow superficial and not getting down to really deep issues. I went and spoke with one of the leaders, and he said, Gordon, you must understand that at this university, everybody who arrives believes uncritically in three things: democracy, free market liberalism, and sexual freedom. Mm. So that gave me the idea of Western fundamentalism. A Western fundamentalist is someone who believes uncritically in democracy, free market liberalism, and sexual freedom. And as I talk about in the book, I think that the core idea of free market liberalism and sexual freedom as it's practiced in the West now is a market idea, that we approach each other as selfish individuals to do free and consensual trades. As long as things are consensual and legal, it's okay. And we don't have to worry about justice, love, or anything like that. I think we now have a shrunken conversation in the West where sex is all about consent. Now, that's a shrunken conversation because it used to be about love, and love implies consent, but consent doesn't have to imply love, as the novel 50 Shades of Grey has told us. So I think that free market liberalism and sexual freedom are about trades. I think they owe their ethos to Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher who thought that Christianity corrupted the West by making it value compassion and weakness. And we need to go back to the Greco-Roman values of celebrating beauty and strength. And free market liberalism and sexual freedom reward those who are beautiful and strong. Democracy is different. I think that there still is an echo of the Christian equality of all people in everybody having a vote. And I think as a culture, the West holds on to this idea because of the memory of World War II. I think that people realize that if in our political sphere we adopted the view that the strong and beautiful have a right to crush the weak, then we'd be going back to something like Nazi Germany, and people are horrified by that idea. And I think the number of Holocaust movies and all the World War II paraphernalia and culture is like a religious symbol, Durkheim might have said, that calls us back to this basic belief that World War II was an example of a just war, where the Holocaust really happened, and that we must never ever let this happen again. All of which I agree with.
So there's a kind of tension right in this analysis between the first two and the third. That is the market and the sexual market, and then democracy. And that might explain some of the kind of incoherences, the vehement disagreements, and the inability to articulate a kind of coherent worldview. Is that
absolutely? I think that the most remarkable thing to me is the realization that the sexual revolution, it's often portrayed as a left-wing victory fighting for justice for women, and there's truth in that. But there's also a right-wing triumph of neoliberalism in it. You know, the same people that would be very critical of banks doing whatever they like without regulation, that is to say they want regulation in the economic sphere because they're scared of it. They have a left-wing suspicion of free market liberalism. When it comes to sexual freedom, they want unfettered freedom, and they don't see the inconsistency in that. I think that left-wing people ought to argue for some traditional Christian morality on the grounds of social justice. It is socially just that children grow up in stable families, and too lax a view on sex creates instability and makes less stable families more likely.
Well, as we're coming up to election, I've just picked up a couple of things you've said there about how the weak are being ignored in the system, and also about the importance of having love in the system. How do you want to talk about that as it comes into economics as something that we need to be thinking about as we come towards voting?
Thanks for the question. Free market liberalism left completely on its own would indeed crush the weak and promote the strong and beautiful. And it still does to a large extent in our society. But of course, it's not left to its own. We have a substantial welfare system. In fact, Australia's in the OECD, a country with very unequal incomes. But after you allow for taxes and transfers and in-kind transfers like health and education being more used by people on – public health and education being more used by people on lower incomes, after you allow for all of that, it's a relatively equal place. It's about in the middle of the OECD. So I think both political parties are committed to the welfare system, and I think it's something to treasure.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's something to treasure as well. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about economics and theology. And thank you also for talking to us about your new book, Western Fundamentalism. So if people want to check that out, they can find that, in all good bookshops?
Yes, you can find it on Amazon or at Quorum.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, if you ever thought one of the issues of our capitalist society is work-life balance, well, here is the TV series for you, with the ultimate work-life balance, the way to balance it, or is it? We talk Apple TV's Severance next.
So, Michael, we've got a new stablemate, Laurel Moffat, with her show Small Wonders, where she takes something very small, very specific, interesting occurrence, and yet she makes something huge out of it. She gets a really interesting take on that. So she's got a couple of really interesting episodes coming up, doesn't she?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that have already come out.
She's got this one called Jerry's Lake House, I Live in the Home With You, which is about an Airbnb where that's exactly what happens. The guy who owns the place lives in the house with you.
What, that's a selling point?
This is apparently people come to it. She's got one on the Mississippi River and they attempt to contain it. Mm. And the thing about Laurel is she's a bit like, I guess I think of her as a sort of Flannery O'Connor novelist type person.
Oh, that's a big comparison.
With a sort of quirky and yet insightful take on the world and mm-hmm. the ability to see the kind of metaphorical value in something, some instance like this, and really apply it, make us think. It'll reassure you and disturb you at the same time. So go over and take a look at Small Wonders on the Undeceptions Network at undeceptions.com. Margaret Dave, two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. Well, now Severance. Severance is a 2022 American Apple TV show created by Dan Erickson and directed by Ben Stiller. Yes, Ben Stiller. And Aoife McArdle.
I think Aoife.
That's, well, thank you. On the review aggregator website, Rotten Tomatoes, it has a rating of, wait for it, 98%. Positive, which I think Citizen Kane gets to 100. So that's pretty good. It stars Adam Scott as Mark and includes performances from Christopher Walken, creepy as ever, and Patricia Arquette. Mark works for a company called Lumen Industries as part of their Severance program, in which his non-work memories are surgically separated from his work memories. Mark has agreed to this to escape his grief for his dead wife for at least 8 hours a day. But, well, does he? In this grim depiction of work-life balance, the work self and the outside work self, the outie and the innie being the work self and the outie being the outside work self, have no memories of each other. As Chelsea Steiner put it in her review for The Mary Sue, Severance is many things: a workplace satire, a mystery box show, a meditation on memory and grief. But its most poignant commentary is in how the show artfully captures the experience of working while the world burns around you. Now, here's the setup from the trailer.
Okay, go ahead and have a seat.
My name is Mark S.
I'm Ellie R.
My name is Irving B.
My name is Dylan G.
And I have, of my own free accord,
elected to undergo the procedure
known as severance.
Awesome.
I give consent for the Lumen Corporation.
And it's a good corporation.
To sever my memories between my work life
and my personal life.
I acknowledge that once the procedure is complete,
I will be unable to access my personal memories
whilst on Lumen's severed floor. Nor will I retain work memories
when I return home at the end of the day.
I am aware that this alteration is comprehensive and irreversible.
I make these statements
for me. Okay. So how do you think it skewers the corporate world, Megan?
I really like how it's visually set up in that it just makes the work world, and you've got to remember that the innies, as they're called, the part of the self.
Sounds like belly buttons.
Yeah, it does, which is only experiencing that bit of the world, is trapped in sort of, you know, endless corridors. And sort of hardly any colours, neon
fluorescent
globes, light. Yeah. You know, the greatest excitement of the day is when you get a new stress ball. You know, so it really sets up the torture of, I think, boredom in a way. I mean, what becomes chilling about this work life balance, or so called, is that the poor innie only ever experiences work. So they come back to consciousness just coming out of the elevator into this sterile environment.
Yeah, so it really becomes this work becomes a torture chamber, which is a chilling, kind of chilling thought, because we don't sever. You know, when you propose it, it sounds like, oh, you know, I could go to work, come home, and I don't even need to try and forget my work worries. I just don't have them. I just have this wonderful outside life. But you're essentially now battling. You've turned into two people who are competing between, and that kind of picks up. Perhaps something at the heart of the soul of the modern workplace, that you do have these kind of two lives competing with one another. And perhaps that competition is more nasty than we think. It's more of a death spiral than we think.
And I think the idea too that when you work, you should not bring any of your personal ethic or who you are into the workspace, that you're kind of – because these innies end up being slaves, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's very difficult for them to get out of it because their outie is the one who decides whether they stay there. But the upshot of it is that they're working, and I mean, another chilling thing about the show is that it's very difficult to work out what they're actually producing.
Yes.
Which can kind of feel like that in the modern work world. But then they have no idea about the value of what they're doing. Or whether they're doing something that's evil, even, and with what they would think about it, because all of that forms their ethical self has been divorced from the working self.
Yeah, that's right. It is kind of pointless labor that doesn't seem to have any lasting legacy or meaning. Although it's then formed by this quasi-religious company, which is sort of a little bit like. Now, by the way, we're trying not to give spoilers.
Yeah, we're trying
it's
very hard.
It's very hard not to.
this is an extremely compelling show. Yeah.
But it's a little bit like it's a little bit like Scientology. But really, again, the kind of way in which the corporate world is mimicking the religious one, becoming quasi-religious, and sort of. Not simply seeing itself as a sort of factory for production, but also the site of ultimate meaning, a complete world of reference, and so that's kind of sickening too to watch this corporation Lumen is kind of a total place site for value in some way.
Yeah, because you've still got to control this innie. Yeah, you know, they've still got to be motivated to some extent. They've still got to be stopped from rebelling. And so there is this cult-like, which is completely – whatever they believe on the outside, here, with no reference point, they're basically pulled into this strange cult-like company.
And so here the question for them is there a voice from outside? And this is where it's kind of really interesting from a religious point of view, is because it's like we're living in this world where where is God? I wondered if there was a sort of allegory here that there is an injection of a meaningful book into the world of
intriguingly,
the
because it's kind of a book that otherwise would almost be sort of hackneyed.
Yes.
Out here with the greater human wealth of philosophy and religion over time. But in there, where all of that has been removed, it's an incredible text.
Yeah, well, it is the text, the yes. revered text. And that text actually allows them to think about freedom in some way. And at this point, I think I might be giving too much away. So I would just say this is an extraordinary journey. It's not for the faint-hearted.
I know you like. This is don't binge this. You'll be tempted to because it's extremely compelling. You want to find out what's happening. There's lots of twists, but do not binge. I mean, this really—if you feel like the modern work world is soul destroying—this really comes across.
It really, really does. But we're looking forward for a second season because many of the questions it's raised are not yet answered.
No, the finale was. Some things were wonderfully explained and other things you just edge of your seat, yeah, looking for. Unfortunately, they have option in a second series that's coming, so thank goodness.
Yes, the corporatization of the production of Netflix or whatever Apple has kind of helped us here.
That's right. Thanks for being part of With All Due Respect. Coming up next episode, from the creation of wealth to the creation of beauty. How do we integrate creativity with faith?
And so we talk to artist, thinker and author Makoto Fujimura about the creative impulse. See you then.
Talk to you then.
and Deceptions podcast.